You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow.
How well do you remember 1991? We're about to jog your memory. We're headed back almost two decades to the very first broadcast of Science Friday. Although climate change was on the radar, it was another environmental problem that was making headlines.
The United Nations Environment Program announced that the hole in the ozone layer is widening. And it now covers, in the words of the report, and this is amazing, almost all of North America, Europe, the Soviet Union, Australia, New Zealand, and a sizable portion of Latin America, unquote. What is the threat exactly? What of the future? What can we do about it? Our first guest is the man who started the whole thing. He's Dr. F. Sherwood Rowland, Donald Brenn Professor of Chemistry at the University of California at Irvine. Almost 20 years ago, in 1974, it was Dr. Rowland and his colleague, Mario Molina, who first suggested that the propellant in spray cans, you know, the chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, as they've been called, were depleting the ozone. Let's welcome Dr. Rowland. Welcome to the program.
Good morning from California.
Give us a little bit of a primer about how this whole thing happened. I mean, who looks up in the sky and says, uh-oh, there's a hole in the ozone layer? How did you go about discovering this or postulating it?
This started back in 1972 and 1973 with curiosity on the part of a laboratory chemist, namely me, about what would happen to the chlorofluorocarbon gases, which had just been discovered as being present in the atmosphere essentially everywhere. And so when Dr. Mario Molina joined my research group in 1973, we started out asking that question of trying to figure out what would happen to these molecules. And one by one, we eliminated the things which usually take molecules out of the atmosphere. The chlorofluorocarbons are not soluble in water, so they don't rain out, and they're transparent, so the sun doesn't destroy them with visible radiation, and they don't react to the common oxidizing agents. What they do is go up into the atmosphere, up into the stratosphere, above most of the ozone layer. And when they get above most of the ozone layer, they can absorb short-wavelength ultraviolet radiation from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
What this does is release chlorine atoms. The chlorofluorocarbons contain chlorine, fluorine, and carbon. And when they release the chlorine atoms, a long chain reaction in which each chlorine atom can take out 100,000 molecules of ozone ensues.
Wow. So there's a chain reaction sort of thing going on.
It's the chain reaction that really does it. We meaning the people of the world, we're putting in then and are still putting in now about 1 million tons of CFCs per year into the atmosphere. And when you take 1 million tons of CFCs and multiply by chain length of 100,000, you can see how man can become a competitor with the natural processes, where the ozone depletion is sufficient from man's use of chlorine compounds to compete with the natural processes that remove ozone.
Mm-hmm. Now, before people get confused, because there are two semi-related subjects that I know I've always run into, people getting confused between the greenhouse effect and the ozone hole. Is there any connection between the two?
Both are consequences of the increasing amounts of trace gases in the Earth's atmosphere, and the increases in the trace gases are being caused by the activities of mankind. In the case of ozone depletion, chlorofluorocarbon molecules, once destroyed and then the chlorine is released, can then attack stratospheric ozone, and that's the cause of the Antarctic ozone hole and the loss of ozone over the northern hemisphere. The greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and the CFCs and nitrous oxide and methane, when they accumulate, they prevent the escape of infrared radiation from the Earth with the consequence that the Earth warms up, and that's the greenhouse effect.
Why is it the Antarctic? What is there something about the cold region down there or the place on the Earth where it starts?
It has to do with the characteristic of the meteorology of Antarctica or of the southern polar regions. The air which is over Antarctica at the beginning of the polar winter stays there all winter long, becomes very cold, and when it becomes cold, clouds can form in the stratosphere, which is an unusual process. It doesn't happen over California or over New York or Washington. You don't get clouds in the stratosphere, but you do get them over Antarctica, and the surfaces of these clouds trigger some reactions with nitrogen and chlorine compounds, which set up the chemistry for the first sunlight. And then when spring comes, the sunlight hits this chemistry, releases the chlorine atoms. The chemistry has removed some of their usual curbs, like the nitrogen oxides, and the reactions run wild for about 5 or 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to John in La Jolla, California. John, go ahead.
Well, good afternoon or good morning, Ira. I must admit that I watch you every day on Newton's Apple.
Thank you.
I'm a big fan. And there's no stuffed shirts here.
Okay.
My wife and I were very concerned about the effects and also the linking with global warming. Her home is in England, and it's about 500 years old right on the coast. And if some of these effects do happen, it seems like the home will be gone in a very short time, flooded out. So what I'm wondering are, what are the social implications? Have they been studied? And the second question is, when will these issues become politically realistic, or should I say economically important?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Dr. Rowland, do you want to answer?
The question about, there are two questions there. One has to do with ozone depletion, and the other one has to do with the greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm.
As far as ozone depletion is concerned, that's become very much politically realistic. There's an international convention that was established in September of 1987 called the Montreal Protocol, which called then for a diminution in the amounts of CFCs put into the atmosphere each year. They called for a 50% cutback. Mm-hmm. This was modified in 1990 to call for 100% cutback by the end of this decade. And in the light of the further development of ozone depletion, the recent announcements, this timescale for putting the CFCs into the atmosphere has been moved up by many people into 1995, 1997. One problem with this, of course, is that the CFCs have very long lifetimes in the atmosphere, and so those which are in the atmosphere are going to stay for a long time. The ozone hole will be with us essentially all through the 21st century.
So this is something we have really altered the chemistry of the planet in a certain sense.
We have certainly done that.
Before we answer the second half of the question, let me bring in someone who might want to jump into the fray here and give us an answer on the political and social side. I want to bring in Michael Oppenheimer. He's senior scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund in Washington, and he's in the studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do you remember the question that was asked about the societal implications?
I think there were two questions asked. One had to do with the greenhouse effect and sea level rise, concern about the home in England. And if that house is close to the coast and near sea level, then there could be a problem in future decades because global warming is expected to rise a level of the sea, something on the order of a couple or 3 feet over the next 100 years. On the east coast of the United States, every foot of sea level rise will take away more than 100 feet of beach on the typical beach. I don't know what the situation is where your house is, but there will be a lot of coastal loss.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to when this affects politics and has about the social implications, yes, there have been voluminous studies about the effects of both global warming and ozone depletion on society. There's no question that particularly in countries like the developing countries that lack ability to adapt to such large and rapid changes, that there are going to be large economic and social consequences. In the United States, it's enough said that fast global warming will be costly to adapt to.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, natural ecosystems like forests simply cannot adjust to these changes, and we can expect large losses in biological diversity and in natural ecosystems. But even on the global warming front, there is we have entered the real world of politics because as the treaty process for ozone depletion has been progressing, there has now been convened a similar process, which we hope will have a similar outcome.
You were happy about the other treaty. I mean,
we're
satisfied with that.
We're happy in the sense that the world has gotten around to doing something about it. It's a bit late, and it seems these days that the more we do, we soon find out that it wasn't enough. And that's because I think we let 10 or 15-year slip between the time Sherry Rowland and Mario Molina identified the problem and the time we finally took it seriously politically. Mm-hmm. With global warming, we seem to be taking the problem a little more seriously, we meaning the people of the world, not the United States government, before the effects are clearly manifest and a treaty is being negotiated. We only hope that the U.S. government will shift position and take some political leadership on this matter.
Are you all hopeful? I mean, are you hopeful that there's a way out of this? Dr. Rowland, are you hopeful?
I think that that there's no way out of what we've already done. We lost 6 or 7 years in the early 1980s when we were lax about trying to do further regulations. I am hopeful now that what we are doing will limit the ozone depletion destruction that we're going to have during the 21st century. But as I said before, it's going to get worse for another 20, 25 years and then gradually get better through the 21st century. But what we're trying to do now is to limit that as much as possible.
Michael Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I would add to that that what I hope people will take away from this experience is that when we're dealing with the global environment, global ecosystems, it really doesn't pay to take risks. Because we took it easy in the late 70s and through the mid-80s on this problem, didn't take the threat seriously enough, we were essentially sapped from behind by a big, nasty surprise. And now all we can do is play catch-up, get rid of the chemicals, but we're going to suffer damage. There will be ultraviolet increases. There will be increases in skin cancer. We should take a lesson away with these long-time scale, effectively irreversible problems like ozone depletion or like global warming. We shouldn't take such risks. We should act in advance.
It's like deja vu all over again. Hard to believe that was almost 20 years ago. That was Michael Oppenheimer, who at the time was a scientist at Environmental Defense. And our other guest, F. Sherwood Rowland, went on to share the Nobel Prize for his ozone research 4 years later. Stay with us. Our trip down memory lane continues. Up next, we'll find out what the internet looked like in the early 1990s. I'm Ira Flatow, and you're listening to Science Friday from NPR.